Good morning, brethren. If you have a copy of the scriptures with you, turn to Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15. Mark's gospel has sometimes been referred to as the gospel of action. It's the shortest of all the gospels in terms of its whole narrative. But here in chapter 15, we are taken to the cross. I want to pick up the reading at verse 33 of Mark chapter 15. And when the sixth hour, which would have been noon, had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone else ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." There are also women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the younger, and of Joses and Salome. When he was in Galilee, they followed him and ministered to him. And there were also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. They led him to a place called Golgotha, which is called the place of the skull. Some think it was actually an elevated piece of real estate, a hill outside of Jerusalem. But that's where Jesus suffers and dies. Now, the gospel writers don't tell us a whole lot about the ordeal itself in terms of what the crucifixion entailed. No mention of the number of nails. We're not told exactly where they were put in terms of his flesh. Probably the size of railroad spikes, very sharp, pounded into his wrists, not his palms. The structure of his wrists with his tendons and bones would have been able to support the weight of the body. But again, we don't know all of the particulars. We glean that from secular history books. The crucifixion was an execution that Romans had learned from the Persians. It was the most famous method of execution by the Roman Empire, apparently so popular that up until the time of an emperor named Titus, so many people had been crucified, there was no wood left for crosses, a reminder of Rome's brutality. The Romans would even brag about it, that it maximized pain. The victim suffered intense thirst, constant cramps, throbbing pain, all parts of the body, sleeplessness, hunger, dehydration. Death normally came by way of slow suffocation. But something else we should remember about the cross, what made it such a disgrace. It wasn't just the pain, but it involved shame. Shame. The sufferers are stripped of all their clothes and they were put into a public venue. The crosses were not erected in a far-off place, out of a way place, but usually along major roads or thoroughfares. The Romans wanted everybody to see. They wanted to let people know this is what happens when you stand up against the Roman government. And what Mark emphasizes, perhaps even more than the other three synoptic gospels, is the cruel taunts and ridicules. That's really where he spends most of his time, verses 29 to 32. There was this relentless mockery and this verbal attacks upon Jesus. But unquestionably, this was the darkest hour in history. Literally, it does become dark, doesn't it? Both Mark and Matthew tell us of a darkness that blankets the cross. It could have been a global darkness, like a global flood, a picture of judgment, but God is very active. God is active when his son is on the cross. His son becomes the guilty sinner. He's being bruised for our iniquities. God is doing something far worse than the crucifixion itself. God is pouring out his wrath upon his son. That's what makes the cross such a dark and terrible place. But in the midst of this horrific darkness, there are a few lights shining. Did you say that here? Mark 15, verse 39. A Gentile. It does appear that he believes. The first conversion experience after the thief there on the cross. After that God-forsaken cry, this Roman centurion who was the nearest to the cross draws a conclusion. It really does sound like a declaration of faith. Truly this man was the Son of God. Well, there's a bright light shining. Well, you have this intense darkness, people mocking and scorning Jesus. There is this one man who stands up for Jesus. And he protests his innocence. He's not guilty. There's a terrible injustice here. But there's more light here in the midst of the awful darkness and horrible blackness of human sin and divine judgment. Verses 40 and verse 41 spotlights a group of faithful followers. Again, not what you would expect. A group of women standing off at a distance. And Mark uses a very strong verb here to capture what they are doing. It's the Greek word theruo, where we get our English word theater. They're making a very astute observation. That's what the word connotates. It involves one's cognitive power. They have to be employed when you come to this verb. Again, think of what's happening here. The person they deeply loved and cared for is being horribly, verbally, physically crucified right there in front of their eyes. You would think that all of their emotions would be running wild, even somewhat of a hysteria. Anger, fear, sadness could easily have gotten into the driver's seat. But what Mark puts the emphasis here is upon the mind. Not upon the emotions. It's not that their emotions were flatlined. I don't think that's what he wants us to draw from this. They were probably deeply grieved, deepest of sorrow. But this word suggests deep thinking and astute observation. You could say it's sort of a detective word, a Sherlock Holmes word. Their emotions are not in control. You see, grace is stronger than our emotions. Remember the grace of love and how it's described in 1 Corinthians 13, a love that suffers long, is not easily provoked, believes all things, endures all things. And I think we see something of that here. 1 John 4 tells us, there is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. Fear would have said, stay away. If fear would have said, protect yourself. This is risky. But they don't run. They stand like sentinels in the midst of a mob when hatred and persecution had reached its awful climax there at the cross. And why are they there? Well, it's love. It's their steadfast, loyal love. We know from Luke's gospel that these same women had served Christ, they'd followed him, and they had ministered to him. They had prepared meals for our Lord. They probably did a lot of the grocery shopping and filleting of the fish and cooking the meals and doing all of those little things for Jesus. So it sort of underscores again that they were devoted followers, faithful in little, faithful in much. That's often how it works. They were devoted to Jesus in everyday service. Good times, when things are going great, but also in the worst of times. It's easy to be a follower of Jesus when Jesus is popular. It's easy to be a follower of Jesus when the culture in which we live manifests a high level of tolerance, and we've enjoyed that in North America, both USA and Canada, almost from the very beginning. It's pretty easy to follow Jesus when life's like that, when you grow up in a church-friendly culture. But things are changing faster than anyone would have dreamed. Most of us could say at work, no big risk on college campus, a university, no big risk in coming to church, owning a Bible, and telling others about Jesus, no big risk. But it's changing real fast. Testing times, shifting times are coming to the church. Will we remain faithful like these women? They were prepared to take risks for Jesus because they loved him, and we are to love him. Jesus is to be more than an ice cream flavor, more than a nice little ornament on a Christmas tree. He has to be more than just somebody you talk about. He has to be a person you know, you love, and you serve. And when tough times come, you stay near the cross. The words of the Hebrew writer he wrote to Christians who were in the midst of big time persecution. And remember what he tells them to do in Hebrews chapter 12. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of your faith. Run the race, he says. Lay aside everything that encumbers you. Look unto Jesus. That's the key, isn't it? It's a faith look. You keep your eyes fixed upon Jesus. And so no matter how perplexed, how confused, how dark life becomes, you stay devoted to Christ. We stay faithful. Temptations, afflictions, sorrows, disappointments are sure to come. And the longer you live as a Christian, they seem to pile up, don't they? Life doesn't get easier. I don't think it does. It gets more difficult. Tougher. So you've got to keep your eyes on Christ and his cross, and you stay faithful to the end. That's why he gave us this table and this ordinance called the Lord's Supper, to help us keep our focus upon him. In essence, that's what it says. Keep your eyes on Christ. Stay loyal, stay faithful.